guy named Peter Boehringer, who was an AfD delegate from Munich. And Boehringer started spreading this theory that the Americans had stolen Germany's gold. The Americans had melted it down. They had misplaced it. They had expropriated it themselves. And that we want to see the gold. Like, show us the gold. And this is funny until the Bundesbank says, okay. So that's the crazy part, is the Bundesbank was like, you're right, you've got a point. And they bring back a big chunk of the German gold reserves and have a public exhibition of the gold in Frankfurt, wow, where you can come in and be like, okay, good, it's here. But then, of course, like this is why it's like an even better illustration of this logic, is Boehringer goes and he's like, that's not the real gold.
Welcome to the Heist Podcast. I'm Benjamin Stoller. This week we have the audio of a live event that we had back in May with author Quinn Slobodian in conversation with our Heist founding editor, Peter Matthews. There were about 50 or 60 of us back then at Chapters Bookshop in Moabit, where incidentally I also record these podcasts. And it was the first Heist event, which we actually sold out right away. It was super cool to get to meet some of you, some Heist readers and some followers, and connect. And we're hoping to be able to do more of that kind of thing as the year goes on. So stay tuned for that, or send us some ideas if you have some cool locations to do events or cool ideas. Anyway, to introduce Quinn Slobodian, he's the author of a few books, but specifically he and Peter discuss two of them. Hayek's Bastards from last year, a book that made a big splash because it traces the intellectual history of the far right in some surprising ways. And also his newest book, Muskism, co-authored with Ben Tarnoff, which came out just a few months ago this year. And that one looks at Musk and his industrial strategies and the wider implications of his successes. Like it looks at it like a kind of Fordism on ketamine and mushrooms, which is something we should keep in mind and pay attention to, because he just became the world's first trillionaire after the IPO of his company SpaceX just a few weeks ago. And Berlin specific, in the second half of this episode, Slobodian talks about the AfD and the tradition it emerged from. So the whole episode connects Muskism and the AfD in trying to get to the bottom of the question, why is this particular version of madness rewarded? Before we play the audio of the event, I want to say thanks again to those of you who've signed up for Heist or shared the podcast around in the last couple weeks. We've seen some really great sign up and download numbers, and I want to reiterate and ask again, please help us keep that up by signing up for free to Heist, or help us, if you can, extend our cash runway and survive even longer by becoming an accomplice, which you can do starting at €9 monthly at heistberlin.com. So bear with us. This episode is a bit longer than the usual ones, but I think it's worth it to hear how Quinn Slobodian connects the dots. And yeah, it's a live event, so the audio sounds like it's a live event. But okay, that's enough. Let's get going. Here's Peter Matthews and Quinn Slobodian.
Yeah. Yep. Thanks very much. Okay, yeah, thanks all for coming. All right, so, yeah, I wanted to start with some questions about Muskism and then go to Hayek's Bastards in that order, kind of. But, yeah, what I like about Muskism is that it's this attempt to understand Elon Musk not so much as a person, but as a kind of system or emblematic of the time in some kind of way. Yeah, can you describe that? What is the way that capital is relating to the world under Muskism?
Sure, yeah. First of all, thank you, everybody, for coming through the dregs of the rain. It's very nice to be here. Berlin is a place that's very close to me. It's sort of a second home for me. And a lot of the work I've done has been written here. In fact, the second half, especially the cyborg half of Muskism, which I'm sure we'll end up talking about, was mostly written in a blessed two-week period that I was living on Maybach Ufer last summer without my 9-year-old child, who I love very dearly, but who I had more or less been chained to since his birth 9 years ago. And this was the first two-week period I had to write, and it happened. It really happened. Like, there was a lot pent up, and I was able to get into Musk's mental zone and then mercifully depart it, having left the trace of the chapters that are in the second half of the book behind. But the approach that me and my co-author Ben Tarnoff took. And so, you know, first of all, this is a co-authored book. We read it, wrote it 50%, 50%. It was not just me. Was first to kind of do this thought experiment, which was, you know, what if we were young-ish, middle-aged, approaching socialists, intellectuals, would-be intellectuals in the 1920s and 30s looking at Henry Ford. What would our relationship to the figure of Henry Ford be, right? Would we look at him and just say, this guy is a monster and he disgusts me and I don't want to think about Henry Ford, so I'm going to focus on other things? Or would we do what someone like Antonio Gramsci did sitting in prison and say, like, wait, Ford is not just Ford. Ford is something larger than himself. And what Ford is doing in his factory is not actually the most important story. What's happening in his factory is it's creating an engine of accumulation that then reshapes the social world outside of the factory, that changes everything from the family and sexuality and gender relations to the relationship between nations, to the relationship to the minerals under the earth, to the consumer markets that emerge afterwards. So what Gramsci did and what we then, you know, somewhat, I guess, vaingloriously did in the path of Gramsci was to say, well, what if we thought about Musk like that too? We hated Musk as much as the next person, maybe even more. You know, I quite literally did mute him on X and Twitter when I was still on that platform for years. I was just like, whoop, free of him. But then at some point, like in a specific point in early 2025, when he was running amok through the U.S. government, it was just like, that's not adequate. Like, that's not sufficient. Like, this man needs to be looked in the face. And the way we'll look him in the face is by not looking him in the face, by looking at the implications of the suite of products and services and all that they span, his relationship to the government, the origin of his ideas, the different waves of investment cycles and new state needs and consumer needs that have made him this unprecedentedly wealthy person and someone who is has this load-bearing status now. He's a pillar of the global political economy in a way that needs to be confronted. So, you know, that, I mean, that was the approach, was to begin to see him not in his own words at all, right? Like, actually, The Economist just gave a very, like, nicely flattering, especially because The Economist review of our book, where they said this is the inverse of the Walter Isaacson biography, mm-hmm. even though they had no access to Musk. They're not interested in what's in Musk's head, but they said that for that, it's actually more revealing about the influence of Musk and the power that he wields, because it de-psychologizes and it de-pathologizes in a way by just saying he's actually not a aberration. He's actually like the leading indicator or the indicator species of the version of capitalism we've all, you know, collectively built.
With that in mind, I mean, one of the things that you say is important in the book is, like, it's important not to think of Musk as this kind of individual. But as you also say, you know, people had those stickers that they put on their Teslas, you know, like, I bought this before Elon went crazy. Mm-hmm. And, but so do you think that tracing his story, you can see a moment of change in mm-hmm. his? Or, and then how do you read that? Like, how do you read that trajectory when you're trying not to psychologize him?
Yeah. So, I mean, when we started writing the book, because it was like the high point of Doge and so on, this was the first question people would ask of us is, like, what happened to Elon? Like, when did things go sideways for Musk? And we, you know, apart from trying to say, well, we're not exactly just trying to figure out Elon, we were nevertheless kind of bound by our method. And our method is to use his biography to kind of walk a reader through, like, the different phases of the recent past. So he becomes like a quite helpful pedagogical tool, because you can introduce people to, like, moments that maybe they had forgotten about or never known about. The way that the global war on terror produced a new market for a certain kind of technology, the way that Obama's moment of green industrial policy produced a market for a certain kind of technology, the way that the move into things like more outre things like AI and brain-computer interfaces produce new demands. And Musk was there, but he wasn't the one, in most cases, who was the primary actor. He was often coasting behind other people who had opened up new sectors, or else just having his antenna out and being like, what is necessary right now? Like, what is getting money, basically, mostly from the government, that will grease the rails for me to enter this and to gather more money as I go? So if you think about it that way, then you're kind of forced to answer the question of when did Musk go crazy a little differently, right? The question is less, you know, what happened in his personal life than what happened structurally that made the expression of craziness, as we recognize it, nevertheless highly lucrative for Musk, right? Because I think that's probably the most important thing to bear in mind, is that his personal net worth has borne no injury from the appearance of going crazy. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's the opposite. That the things that liberals or even many of us in this room would describe as derangement have been rewarded, you know, serially by the most sober-minded members of the global investor class. So our subjective understanding of what craziness is must be, at least in the kind of the judgment of the market, you know, exactly incorrect, right? Like somehow we have the wrong measure of madness. Like we don't know what crazy means when it comes to the function of the market as like the space of veridiction, as Foucault called it, like the place where truth is actually decided. Doesn't matter what you think it is, the market tells the truth. And, you know, for all of the challenges that neoliberalism has had in recent years, that is one thing that seems to remain a helpful way to try to figure out what's going on. So the way we approach the question is a couple ways. One is to backtrack it. So a lot of the things that get read as Musk's craziness are to do with his increasing fusion with online network technologies. So often people will say it's a combination of like doing too much ketamine and posting too much. Mm-hmm. We're in Berlin. I'm sure a lot of people have suffered these very same maladies. Like this is a very relatable part of actually the Musk biography. But you know, what was he doing? Was that him going off the deep end? Was he getting addicted to social media / addicted to drugs? At some point, we had a great moment. I was talking about this to Peter and Ben in the back, that we talked to this artist that maybe some people in this room know, Bahar Narazadeh, who used to live in Berlin. She's doing a great project called Weird Economies. And she did a really interesting video called Teslaism. And that at some point involved like the crossover. Apparently there may be a nightclub underneath the Gigafactory. This is like one of
allegedly,
the urban myths.
Yeah.
But we do know that you know, Sven denied entrance for Musk to Berghain.
But he went to Git Kat, I think.
Oh, well, but there was like Ben, my co-author, was at the time reading the biography of Trotsky, and there was some description that Isaac Deutscher uses about how you know, that history was knocking at the door and Trotsky opened it or something like that. And we thought this is the reverse. Like history was at the door and like Sven said no. And then unfortunately, like the inverse of Trotsky happened, which is Muskism. Which I'm not like totally joking, because I think there are ways that his embeddedness into subcultural, you know, the mystique of subculture and the erratic ways that drugs can make your mind go had different outcomes. And it ended up getting shaped in a particular way by also the material incentives around him, right? So he was encouraged to go crazy in the particular way that he went crazy, because it was lucrative for him to go crazy in those ways. So what were those ways? This is like an insanely long preamble to this question, but we backdate it to, for one thing, the launching of OpenAI with Sam Altman. Why do we do that? Because the launch of OpenAI in 2015 with Sam Altman was very much under the sign of existential risk, Nick Bostrom theories of runaway digital superintelligence that, if left unregulated, would turn humanity into paper clips, gray goo, something else, right? So the point of OpenAI on paper and seemingly genuinely was to be very engaged with questions of AI alignment and AI safety to make sure that you didn't accidentally trigger like a runaway process of the a malevolent AGI. So that has earned Musk at the time a kind of label of AI skeptic, or even his nomination in 2015 as Luddite of the Year is never like ceases to make me laugh. Especially because almost immediately after he founds OpenAI, he founds Neuralink, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, within about like 18 months. And the point of Neuralink is to, as he describes it, not just make things better for people with quadriplegic, you know, immobility or who've suffered accidents, but to expand the interface of interaction between network technologies and the human brain from the kind of pinpoint of our thumbs and our eyes to like a great rushing river through, you know, a kind of broadband link up into the brain tissue itself. So that seems like a strange thing for a Luddite to do, obviously, right? But it actually makes sense in his own terms, because the argument was, because there's the danger of a runaway malevolent superintelligence, you need to create what he called the human-machine symbiote and accelerate the creation of what he also called the giant cyborg that we're becoming, or the, quote, giant cybernetic collectives that we're becoming in relationship to our devices, to make sure we stay one step ahead of that Skynet superintelligence. Mm-hmm. So if you ask me, that's when he started going crazy, right? I mean, like, from my point of view, that's a tick beyond, like, actually a solid grasp on reality. And yet, you know, and because of that moment of the cyborg turn, as we think about it in the book, that a lot of what happens later that becomes more obviously crazy seeming follows. Because, you know, to put it shortly, when ChatGPT debuts in 2022 as the first really consumer successful rollout of LLM technologies, all of a sudden the whole investment story and growth story for Silicon Valley changes from Web 2.0 to generative AI. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of false starts in between, right? There was Web 3, there was the metaverse, there were NFTs, there was crypto. These were all them desperately trying to figure out what the next big thing was, and none of them worked, right? They spent huge amounts of money. Huge amounts of money was raised, assuming that those were going to be the next big thing. They weren't. ChatGPT was it. So what happens when ChatGPT was it? Well, Musk and Andreessen and others start playing with ChatGPT, and what do they start getting? To their horror, they find out that because the training data of these LLMs is the internet of, you know, 2010 to 2024, it has the politics of the internet of 2010 to 2024. So it believes that Black Lives Matter. It believes that you should defend trans kids. It believes that, you know, gender equality is a thing. And when queried about these things, it produces answers that to them were like the automation of wokeness. Mm-hmm. That wokeness had now actually exited human agency and entered like a now an automated space that had unbelievable dangers inherent in it for human futures. So if you think there's going to be a runaway Skynet digital superintelligence, and then you think, oh my God, it's not that, but it is a woke runaway digital superintelligence, then you get really motivated to figure out how to stop that like as soon as possible. And this is one of those things that, you know, I'm describing, and I'm like, that really sounds crazy now, but like, but that is really exactly what Musk is saying, and what Andreessen is saying, and what the A16Z and the All In podcast guys are saying, is the dominant technology that is the frontier technology of our moment, LLMs, is shot through with the politics of the training data in such a way that it needs to be very heavily intervened in with, you know, reinforcement learning with human feedback and retutored, and the weights need to be changed and so on to make sure that it achieves what they think of as truth, but in their more honest moments they think of as like the anti-woke mind virus, the anti-woke AI. So XAI when it's founded, and Grok when it's rolled out as the chatbot on top of XAI, is described as first speaking in the voice of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is quite funny. And it does actually do that. If you queried it early on, which I did, it would just be like, oh, hey, ho, neighbor. Like it did this really hokey, like 70s, like dad jokes. But then it says like, and it will answer spicy questions that other models refuse to answer. which, as we know, later ended up meaning that it would just talk about white genocide unprompted to every query. Yeah. Because, and the point being that it's actually hard to make an anti-woke AI, right? An anti-woke LLM, because it's a probabilistic engine and it doesn't actually respond very well to direct commands. It doesn't work that way. Like, it works from the accumulation of all of the things that it's ingested and then like extrudes like the mean of that. So it tends to the middle of the bell curve. Mm-hmm. Actually, and it's not a polarizing engine, actually, the same way social media is. And some people are starting to think, maybe chatbots are actually the secret to political polarization. Like, coming soon to like a Bundeszentrale für politische Bildung conference near you. Like, everyone needs to get on chatbots to save democracy in the Federal Republic. I'm not joking at all. Actually, I've just spent 3 days at Republica. I think that was something that was being talked about there. So I think that like once you've settled on that, what I need to do is build the anti-woke AI, and I need to basically subordinate all of my companies to fund XAI because it is the mecha Hitler that will defeat the woke super nanny that quote unquote wants to turn me into a woman of color, which is something that he said on Joe Rogan. Then, you know, his craziness is maybe not explained, but it's reframed, right? That you see like, oh, it's because he's in too deep. Like, his idea of like cybernetic fusion has produced these derangements in him that no longer really align with normal people's ways of understanding the world, but to return back to the beginning, are nevertheless seemingly highly persuasive investment strategies to the most mediocre and unred-pilled asset managers in the world. Mm-hmm. So that is actually the long kind of loop that we had to kind of trace our way through to figure out Musk's craziness.
Yeah, it's a tough job to have to be in Musk's mind that much, I think.
Yeah, it is.
But also, I wanted to ask, because you're focused on the kind of longer story, I'm wondering a bit about which elements of his biography you think are the most kind of pressing. And I thought maybe you could start with, can you tell us who is 104501, if you know what I mean, which is, I think, the name that his grandfather preferred to go by.
Yeah, so, you know, people probably heard reference to this before, but Elon Musk's maternal grandfather was part of something called Technocracy Incorporated, which was a political movement in the 1930s in Canada and the United States that, let's say, took the thing that was quite general, which was the experience of the First World War, which, you know, was the first really mechanized war. You know, the First World War, as I always talk to my students about, started with basically cavalry horses and ended with tanks and poison gas. So it was when the consequences of really the Fordist model of production became realized at scale for like mass annihilation and warfare. And that was, of course, horrifying to many people, but also quite exciting to other people because it suggested how you could do like total war in peacetime and transform the whole way of organizing economies and populations the same way that you used a kind of top-down command and control to fight the war. So what if you could do that to society? Well, I mean, that was one of the inspirations for fascism, certainly, but it was also one of the inspirations for communism and socialism. And it was the inspiration for Technocracy Incorporated, which to Elon Musk's maternal grandfather, who was a chiropractor in Saskatchewan, suggested that maybe he could play a key role in dissolving the countries of North America down to Venezuela into one giant space called the Technate, where there would be no money, no votes, and everyone would truck and barter in something called ergs. And ergs were the amount of energy that each human life, you know, produces metabolically over the course of your existence. So humanity would be reduced to their capacity to expend energy and metabolize energy. And there would be a appointed class of engineers, technocrats, quite literally, who would oversee this process. So that's what his grandfather was up to. He ended up being imprisoned briefly because of the support of technocrats for Nazi Germany at the beginning of the Second World War. And then disgruntled with the political possibilities of the pretty vanilla scene of post-war Canada, he went to somewhere spicier, as Musk would put it, which was apartheid South Africa, which had just rolled out apartheid 2 years earlier. So it was a gesture of solidarity with the new apartheid modernizing state, and he said so openly. It was a way to find a way out of, and this is maybe anticipates question you're going to ask in a minute, but like a way out of the Cold War binary. It's not just capitalist America and communist Soviet Union. He and many other people saw South Africa as like a modernizing reactionary state that was equipping itself with new technologies. By the 80s, it's like IBM mainframes. They've developed their own nuclear bomb. They've imported licenses to build their own Fords and Datsuns and all kinds of other automobiles. So they are using a model of what we call in the book Fortress Futurism, which is neither Soviet nor American capitalist, but kind of something else, which takes advantage of the global market, but is really premised on this idea of like a community that is driven together by risks and by threats, both beyond the borders and also inside the borders. So even though it's not in the traditional way something we can trace from point to point in Musk's biography, we think that the way that Musk sells his products now, whether it's like the Tesla dome that can protect you in times of climate breakdown or social unrest, or you know the war-making capabilities of Starship or Starlink, these things all kind of channel the South African technocratic spirit of fortress futurism, which is an enclave, hardened society overseen by adepts, engineering adepts, who in many cases overrule popular sovereignty or self-determination questions, certainly any idea of one person, one vote, in the interest of optimizing your ability to defend the chosen people.
Well, I think that's interesting also because there's some moments in the book, I'm almost personally even too used to thinking of Musk as like a ridiculous figure in some kind of way. But there are moments in the book where you see that he's kind of actually intuiting something ahead of everyone else. Like he's actually noticing something. And I think specifically something that you describe is like he notices something about how money can relate to the state and like how it can kind of harness the state and use it to its own advantages. What is that that you think? What is that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, there's for a while now, people have been writing books about, say, the history of Silicon Valley or the history of digital capitalism. And often the kind of like revelation is like, hey, Silicon Valley relied on state funding. Therefore, their libertarianism is bunk or suspect or whatever. And that's kind of sometimes the big revelatory move, which by now is like, we know, like we have that magic trick figured out. Nobody's surprised anymore. We know that, DARPA funded the internet and then handed it to private actors in 1995. We know that the Silicon Valley sector survived from demand from the military state in the 1960s and 70s and then after as well. And in fact, we know so much that there's a number one New York Times bestseller called The Technological Republic, written by Palantir CEO Alexander Karp, in which he says, we already all know this. So let's stop focusing on that. Instead, start from the point that often ends, which is that Silicon Valley is the kind of product of the American military state. And Karp's argument is, and it should get back to doing the thing it was built to do, which is serve the American military state. And that's what the technological republic is like the function of big tech will not be to produce convenience or, daily pleasure or rising prosperity even, but to protect Americans against threats from outside their borders and inside their borders. So that is that's the state of play right now, right? So I think that, if you want to understand the mega tech tie up or the direction for investors that makes people excited for new startups in the Valley now, it's all headed in that direction, right? It's all hard tech, it's all military tech. It all has the state actually often as its primary customer in mind. Mm-hmm. So that's in a way just like basic reporting, right? Like that we just know that that's currently true. What's interesting about Musk is he did kind of, whether through his superior insight, his childhood in South Africa, or dumb luck, end up really being a kind of forerunner for that model of like Silicon Valley's primary customer is the state, and so we align our investments in that direction. Case in point, most obvious, is SpaceX, which launches in 2002. And it launches in 2002, the first year of the global war on terror, because of something that happened, as we describe in the book, the day before 9/11. So the day before 9/11, September 10th, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld gives a speech in the Pentagon, and he says, the Cold War is over. The Soviet Union was defeated. Now we have a new enemy, and it's a lot like the Soviet Union. It is rule-bound, it's authoritarian, it's top-down, it's centralized, it's not very responsive to outside stimulus, and it is us. We, the Pentagon bureaucracy, are the new enemy. We need to defeat this legacy of rigid, bureaucratic, Soviet-style thinking in our own ranks, and we need to get all of those like young guns from Silicon Valley to come out and help us do this. And next day, of course, the whole security environment changes. And one of the things that Rumsfeld is already saying at that point is the way that wars are going to be fought is going to be different. This becomes called the Rumsfeld Doctrine. It's not going to be large land-based armies, boots on the ground, even though, of course, it ended up being more than that than he hoped. It's going to be mostly about agile special forces deployed all over the world with satellite-guided munitions that back them up. So we're going to need, among other things, a huge array of new tactical satellites that are taking advantage of the GPS system, which has only been perfected within the last decade. And that's where Musk steps in and says, I've got you. SpaceX is going to provide for you what you need, and we're going to put those satellites into orbit for you much more cheaply. And he does. So, and then over the next 20 years, he lowers the cost of putting mass in orbit by 90%. He now is responsible for 80% of rocket launches, of orbital launches worldwide, and 95% in the United States. And soon he starts making his own satellites, as maybe some people know. 2019, he starts putting Starlink satellites in the air. Now, just 7 years later, there's 11,000 satellites. He has a request in to the FCC to put 1 million satellites into low Earth orbit. This wasn't a viable space for internet connectivity until he pioneered it. And, again, most people in this room probably know this, but SpaceX will go public next month at a projected value of $1.75 trillion, which will be the biggest IPO in history, and immediately make SpaceX the sixth most valuable company in the world. So this has been a very successful model for him to graft himself onto primarily the state as customer. And so the moment in which he was even doing, we were talking in the back about like when was Elon kind of cuddly, like when did liberals like Elon in the United States anyway, and certainly places like Holland and Germany too, was when he was focused on electric vehicles, right? Mm-hmm. When Tesla was the thing that was most identified with him. But even there, and this is something that I'm quite happy that we talk about in the book because I don't think it's well known, there's a state symbiosis tie-in as well, because if he gets his start with SpaceX in the rollout of the global war on terror, Tesla ends up profiting from the backlash against the war on terror. So just 6 years later, 2008, Obama becomes the chosen Democratic candidate as the anti-war candidate, right? He gets the nomination because Hillary was for the war and he was against it. Coming into the White House, he's dealing with, clusterfuck in Iraq and a global financial crisis, which means that the major auto companies are going bankrupt at the time, right? What does he do? Something very smart, which he says, the way we can actually get ourselves out of the Middle East, save the auto sector, and make things different and better in the United States is by going hard into renewables, electrify the auto sector, and do basically like green industrial policy with all of the tools of the state available. That way we'll have what we call electric autonomy. We will not have to fight wars in the Carter Doctrine sense to protect oil resources in the Middle East. And he's looking around. There's not actually that many people are making cool EVs, except for this guy named Elon Musk, who just becomes the CEO of Tesla and the primary investor in 2009. Mm-hmm. Gets a $500 billion loan from the Department of Energy, life-saving loan for Tesla, and that ends up being really successful. Why don't we know about that or think about it? Because just a couple of years later, the shale revolution means that America doesn't have to worry about oil anymore. It uses fracking technology to take oil out of its own you know, deposits mostly in Texas. And then now, as we know, it's the world's net exporter, it's a net exporter of petroleum rather than an importer, which is the term, the conditions of possibility for the reckless self-destructive war that it's conducting in Iran right now. Obviously, making one of those moments, you know, you have Sven saying no to Musk at Berghain, and then whoever, whatever asshole developed fracking technology, like if that had not been developed, then, you know, maybe in our fondest dreams, America could be China right now.
I wonder, I mean...
There's still time, by the way. I don't know if anyone's watching the Beijing visit recently.
I want to turn to Hayek's bosses and talk about this, but one of the interesting things, I wonder a bit about the connecting tissue between the two books. And also, I wanted to know, I mean, we also, since we're in Germany, we've seen Musk make this explicit appeal to support the AfD, appear at their rallies. And I think that in Hayek's bosses, one of the things that's interesting there is that you trace how the politics of the far right actually doesn't emerge in, you know, some people say in reaction to neoliberalism, or but actually from within it. The intellectual tradition of neoliberalism actually has a lot of the equipment which gives the far right their intellectual framework. So I wonder if we can kind of put those things together somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say a couple things about that. I mean, one is that this book really came out of 2016-17. It was a long time cooking, and it was ended up kind of like part of another book, the Crack Up Capitalism book, and then kind of got shorn out of it and then lived this longer life. And then by the time like Milei was becoming the, you know, the head of Argentina as a devotee of Murray Rothbard, I was like, okay, I've got a lovely bookend here. But yeah, 2016-17, and you know, many people probably remember this. This was a common narrative, which was like, neoliberalism went too far. Globalization has kind of produced its own gravediggers. The left behinds of the heartlands have now had their revenge. And if you're a critic of neoliberalism, you might wish for a different outcome, but you kind of have to like grudgingly like hand it to the people who get, who are like the mouthpieces of the people who have been fucked over basically by 15, 20 years of free trade deals and inattention to people who are just seen as disposable or surplus. And, you know, there is something to that argument if you look at it from what populism scholars call the demand side, which is like, why did people vote for Trump? Well, yes, people in Michigan and Wisconsin voted for Trump because they saw their livelihoods, you know, gutted from one or two generations to the next. But if you look at the supply side, which is like who's doing the talking, who's serving as the vessel for those kind of politics, and then furthermore, do they actually follow through on any of the promises that they make to the people who voted for them, then the story actually changes almost 180 degrees. And I use examples of that in Hayek's Bastards to make the point that the economic advisors who were literally writing Trump's tax policy and his economic policy in his first term were Arthur Laffer, if anyone's heard of the Laffer curve. I mean, the father of supply side economics, Reagan's primary advisor, Trump's primary economic advisor, wrote a book called Trumponomics. It's not like it's hidden. It sold pretty well. And what does he advise him to do? To do tax rates cuts for the wealthiest, which is the only real legislative accomplishment of Trump's first term, is the 2017 tax cuts, that are just doctrinaire, Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute, Reagan era policies. So for me, there was a kind of frustration that I saw a lot of pundits, and this has changed now, but it really was the case in 2016-17 that people would just be like, it's so sad that neoliberalism went too far and there was this backlash and now what we have is populism. And I'm just like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, look at what these people are actually doing. Like, they are following like chapter and verse neoliberal policies. They're doing nothing to address those very things that may have swept them into power. Galloping inequality, deindustrialization, you know, subjugation to the global rule of the market, etc. So that was in the US very clear, and in Germany like almost more clear, right? And because the AfD, as I'm sure everyone knows, is like founded by ordo-liberal economics professors from Hamburg and elsewhere, and they found the party in a way that actually ended up splitting the Friedrich Hayek Society, which they were all members of, because they thought that, you know, it was sensible to make alliances with ethno-nationalists and German chauvinists to save the German economy from being undermined and eventually destroyed by Europeanism, by the European Central Bank, which they saw as profligate, bailing out the supposedly, you know, wasteful Southern Europeans. They needed to get back to the Deutschmark, which then meant, of course, to their allies in the ethno-chauvinist wing of the party, get back to, you know, like a blood and soil vision of Germany. But the founders of the party were not actually blood and soil style chauvinists in the first instance. They were thinking economically. Their turn to the right, their turn to populism was argued in economistic terms, that we actually need to restore German values that are primarily economically understood. Even Thilo Sarrazin, right, who writes the book that meant the most really for the revival of the far right in Germany, Deutschland schafft sich ab, is a very weird book. Like, I don't know how many people have tried to read that book. Interesting, almost nobody. Then you definitely haven't read the footnotes. Because if you had, you find something really crazy, actually, which is kind of the whole argument of Hayek's Bastards, which is, how does Sarrazin make the case for immigration restrictionism? Does he say that, you know, there are Christian or even Judeo-Christian values that need to be protected against Muslim values? No, not really. Does he say that, like, Germany has a proud tradition and Europe has produced, I don't know, Plato to NATO or whatever? No, he doesn't say that either. What he says is, look at these psychology journal articles, which show that on average, populations from Muslim-majority countries have lower IQs, which we can understand economically to mean they have worse impulse control, they have an inability to think in long term, they have a more of a likelihood to become welfare dependents, and a less likelihood to become productive entrepreneurial members of the class. So he actually makes the argument against Muslim immigration on these pseudo-scientific social science grounds. It's actually not ethno-nationalist in any way that you would recognize that. It's economistic thinking, which suited him as an economist, former board member of the Bundesbank, and so on. So that's, you know, that's, because I'm sure we don't have time to get into the whole thesis, that's the argument of that book, is like a lot of the things that were interpreted as a turn away from economic thinking to its supposed opposite, which is like cultural and national thinking, was actually often not that at all. That this idea of folk capital is a kind of radicalization of an idea of human capital, in which populations get understood in economistic terms and then resorted and given new hierarchies along those lines. And IQ ends up being a really important one, which, you know, I unfortunately feel that validated every time you see Musk or Trump, to connect the two books, using low IQ or high IQ as somehow like transparently legible compliments or insults. My favorite being when little X, Musk's son, came into the White House and met Trump, and Trump said, "You seem like a high IQ individual." like who has ever complimented a child who can't actually even speak in that particular way? Like, you can see that some strange scientization of you know, human hierarchy has been so like cooked into these people's brains that's the lens through which they see the world.
Yeah, I'm conscious about time a bit, but I want to ask just exactly this kind of question about when we're thinking about the fundamental idea structure of this that grows out of this project. You talk about the three hards, mm-hmm. that they kind of insist on: hard borders, hard money, and kind of hardwired human nature, mm-hmm. which comes through IQ. Yeah. I wonder how do they arrive at those? How do those become the kind of fundamental, the spine on which they hang their whole body of thought?
Yeah, I mean, to give the kind of starting point of the book that then gets me to that end point, one of the weird things that happened when I was looking in the archives and newspaper articles about, like, what were the neoliberal intellectuals organized in the Mont Pelerin Society seeing themselves somehow in the tradition of Milton Friedman, Ludwig von Mises, and Friedrich Hayek saying at the end of the Cold War? Like, how did they understand that to have happened? Like, how did they explain that apparent, you know, world historical victory? And the very surprising thing that really became the kind of, again, riddle out of which this book came was, like, they were actually pretty unsure if they'd actually won the Cold War. They saw it two ways. One way was, we haven't actually won it, and we haven't won it because social spending actually didn't dip at all as a percentage of GDP. So maybe we actually didn't kill the welfare state. And furthermore, the red menace has just changed colors, and there's now a green menace in this form of environmentalism. There's kind of a pink menace in the form of feminism and gay rights activism. There are other demands as a radicalization of the civil rights agenda, as they see it, towards affirmative action, quotas in the workplace, workplace harassment laws, disability laws that are all infringing on the power of the manager and the boss and giving them less and less space to shape the world as they wanted to. So this was the main discourse they had, was like this communism was actually, in a weird way, hadn't been an issue for decades, right? I mean, you're looking at the world in 1989, 1990 from the United States. You look around for a long time before you find any communists that you need to be worried about. But you can look around and see like, oh, there's a new law about, you know, needing to put in, I don't know, ramps for every business for people in wheelchairs. Or there's a new law that actually does make it possible for women to, you know, accuse their bosses in court of having misused their authority as men. There's Title IX laws in universities. So there are indeed kind of changes in like speech codes and the allowable conduct. However, they interpreted those things as like a new road to serfdom. So what it was called then was political correctness. That was the umbrella term for everything I'm talking about here. We know what it's called now, which is wokeness. And the line from what my protagonists there are saying in 1990 to like a Chris Rufo right-wing Gramscianism in MAGA 2, where you go at the institutions of cultural production and try to tear them out by the root, that's one storyline, right? So that is felt necessary to figure out, like, who were they worried about when the communists were gone, basically? And we know the answer. Feminists, anti-racists, environmentalists. I mean, those are really the Holy Trinity, and that more have been added, of course, over time for them. So the solution they had was, as you say, hard borders, and hardwired human nature. Hardwired human nature becomes a way to say the egalitarian claims of the 1960s and 70s were always based on false premises. The, you know, Franz Boasian idea that race is a social construct is actually always a lie, and the truth of human difference is in the bones and in maybe not quite the skulls, but certainly the DNA. Mm-hmm. And in the 1990s, if you remember the completion of the Human Genome Project, there was a huge amount of talk about DNA, genes, neurogenetic determinism. The gene for this, the gene for that, the gay gene, the criminal gene, everything was being filtered through this like renewed biologicized idea of human nature, which they completely piggybacked onto. And they're like, see, all that social constructionist stuff, all that social movements, all that talk about human equality was always just a big ruse by the left to try to amass more power for themselves. And now we're telling the truth about humans because we're telling the truth about, you know, bodies and inferiority and, you know, statistical averages in racial groups in books like The Bell Curve, for example, which was an enormous bestseller, sold hundreds of thousands of copies, stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for a whole year, is still in print, and is a dense 800-page psychological treatise about the basic inequality of humans. Mm-hmm. So they were onto something, obviously. Someone bought all those books. There was a mood in the air. There was a demand in the American white middle class to have their own superiority revalidated even more than it was already validated and re-entrenched in like a scientific language. And that's the story that I tell from the point of view of hardwired human nature. On hard borders, it's related. It's what I just said about Zaratsin kind of gives you a version of that neoliberals, you'd think if you just, if someone asked you quickly, you'd say, well, don't they want open borders for everything? Like money moves, goods move, people move, go to the place of greatest exploitation, whatever, like make the bosses the most money. But the answer is actually no. And they talk about this in Globalists, the book I wrote a little while ago, that since the 1930s, neoliberals themselves have been like, No, there are human factors. There are sociological factors. If you have mass immigration, people just don't like it. Like, they react. So if you have enough free trade and enough liberalized financial flows, then that can kind of substitute for this other factor of production that like tends to move less. Mm-hmm. So quite literally, they've made that case since the 30s and have justified it away kind of begrudgingly. I mean, Ludwig von Mises said openly, like, I would love it if we had the world's open borders. Like, it would be great if people could just travel around to wherever they're needed. But people are really attached to nationalities. They seem to have a sensitivity about cultural difference. So which is why like Hayek then supports Thatcher's immigration restriction policy, because he's like, I would love to say yes, but I know humans are imperfect, so we have to give a kind of concession to that. So in the 1990s, there's an interesting similar pivot where The Wall Street Journal, for example, in the late 80s, every 4th of July for years would publish the same op-ed that said a new amendment needs to be added to the American Constitution that says there shall be open borders, mm-hmm. which is, again, one of those things that I was like, like rubbing my eyes, like, am I actually reading this right? Because, of course, the right has been accusing the left in the United States for years of being for open borders. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, Clinton built the first part of the border wall. Like, quite literally, Obama deported more people than anyone else before him. Like, the left, the Democrats, are not for open borders. Even socialists have, you know, nuanced thoughts about how that's supposed to work. But Wall Street Journal actually was for open borders in the late 1980s. They're criticizing the militarization of the border, coming down hard on the use of technology to police it. And what's really important to understand about the American right, maybe more than anything, is how they turned away from that vision, right? Like, how they then embraced restrictionism, which is on its face hard to justify under economic logic alone, because you're kind of undermining yourself if you say, no, we're restricting immigration. It's well known that illegal immigration has positive economic benefits because people work without receiving the contributions they make to the social state in the course of working. So if you're just using that cold, hard logic, then you actually would probably be more down for open borders. But in the 90s, they start assembling this argument that comes down on an idea of human hierarchy, which is that, no, we want to close the borders except for people like a bespoke designer version of immigration, that we choose who we want. Fast forward to H-1B model that people like Elon Musk very much mm-hmm. defends in the United States now for Silicon Valley software engineers. Or we just use the rule of thumb, which is like statistical averages say people from Latin America average lower IQ. Therefore, you can do a rough cut and pull a Trump and say, like, why aren't there more Norwegians or whatever? Like, why so many Haitians? And that kind of ratification of like gutter racism through pseudoscience ends up being like quite important, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, it ends up being where the closed borders people and the economic people end up kind of agreeing, and then, of course, reacting to this demand side and seeing like, oh, this anti-immigrant policy works with the base, and so like, let's figure out a way to justify it and so on. Lastly, and just I'll end on that, I guess, is the hard money thing. I have my favorite image, which unfortunately isn't in the book, is an image of Karl Marx's head floating over Frankfurt, which comes from the blog of a guy named Peter Boehringer, who is an AfD delegate from Munich and I think is still in the Bundestag, but began his career as a precious metals consultant. And he posted that image online in that time when he was a blogger and a gold consultant, because he thought that the ECB was the engine of what he called monetary socialism. Not just him, but many people called that. That it was fiat currency was actually the way that the left had bought off oppressed populations, minority populations, immigrant populations, and just purchased their loyalty and created a new permanent constituency for themselves that would never have been able to happen if gold had never been departed from as the backing of currency. And this is, it's actually the essence of the great replacement argument too, is that, you know, the whole project of replacing the population through the import of foreign populations is only possible because of because of money printing and the profligacy of central banks. So you need to go back to precious metal backing. And this is like a pretty crank theory, even in the neoliberal community. So it's actually very unusual to believe that. Most neoliberals think you need like fiat money plus rules. Like that would be like Milton Friedman, James Buchanan. But there are people like Murray Rothbard, Javier Milei's aforementioned, icon, who did think you needed to roll back monetary theory back to like gold. And Boehringer, amazingly, was one of them, was one of the early AfD delegates and ends up being the treasurer for the Bundestag. Because they're like, well, this guy thinks about money a lot. He'll probably be, you know, acceptably frugal because he, you know, is obsessed with the shredding of fiat money as a possibility and getting back to one-to-one gold bars. And it all, like, it's one of those ones in the course of writing this that, like, I'll just mention two things because they're Germany specific and they're pretty wild, actually. One is that when the AfD was getting started, normally if you're a new party, you raise funds through membership dues, and then the federal government matches the membership dues because it's sort of like part of promoting democracy. Mm-hmm. The AfD figured out a hack, which is they didn't actually have to raise membership dues. They could sell gold coins. So the AfD had a gold shop that was literally selling South African Kruger Rands, Canadian maples, Chinese pandas, all of these sort of iconic gold coins issued by the mints of the various countries. And then when someone bought the gold coin from them, they got the match from the federal government [S2] Wow. [S1] To subsidize the AfD in its early days. And in the early days, Bernd Lucke, you know, he boasted that they were the only party headquarters that was also a profit center. So they, you know, that way in which you can kind of monetize distrust in the normal functioning of the government and use it to both undermine existing legacy institutions and also enrich yourself at the same time is like the kind of essence of this right-wing libertarianism that I think is often misunderstood as like the populist right. Mm-hmm. One last thing I'll mention though with the Boehringer thing, just because again it's a Germany thing and it's wild, is that Boehringer started spreading this theory that the Americans had stolen Germany's gold. Has anyone heard about this theory? Yeah. So the argument, which is not an argument, which is true, that the German reserves, the gold reserves, were held in the United States in the course of the Cold War because, of course, if the Soviets advanced, you wouldn't want to let them plunder the gold reserves. So after the Cold War, they stayed there just because, you know, they were always there. And so no one really felt the need to bring them back because no one thought about like national economies needing to have gold within their borders. Actually quite common for like the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve to hold the gold bars themselves. Boehringer starts spreading this kind of suspicion that actually the gold wasn't there anymore. That the Americans had melted it down, they had misplaced it, they had expropriated it themselves, and that we want to see the gold. Mm-hmm. Like, show us the gold. And this is funny until the Bundesbank says, okay. So that's the crazy part, is the Bundesbank was like, you're right, you've got a point. And they bring back a big chunk of the German gold reserves and have a public exhibition of the gold in Frankfurt. Wow. Where you can come in and be like, okay, good, it's here. But then, of course, like this is why it's like an even better illustration of this logic is Boehringer goes and he's like, that's not the real gold. He's like, I can tell the way it's stamped, the way it's shaped. No, they just melted this down and they remelted it down into German-style ingots. Not the real gold. They have still been lying to us, right? So it becomes like the right-wing libertarian equivalent of Obama's birth certificate, mm-hmm. which is like no production of evidence can actually ever satisfy this demand for truth because it's not designed to be satisfied, right? It's not actually seeking affirmation or validation. It's meant to sow suspicion and to continually undermine. So that's the kind of mode of political reasoning and strategizing that I was trying to get to the heart of in the book.
Oh, that's great. Well, I guess as a last question, I wanted to ask about, I mean, something in a way bridging the two books, which is each thing seems to be trying to do this move of like re-naturalizing inequality in mm-hmm. some kind of way, trying to yeah. find the ways that the hierarchies of the world that we live in aren't like created by the way we've decided to organize the world, but are instead sort of baked in and natural. And one way that seemed to be like a kind of futuristic Baroque way of doing that is this simulation theory or something, you know, like this idea that, which Musk is keen on, that we're really living in this simulation, which is on computer servers somewhere else. And so, but it's a, so it seems to be a way of building in that kind of determinism by the, in a kind of Baroque backdoor in some kind of way. And I wondered if, yeah, just if you think that that is, do you think that that is the fundamental move that they're trying to do, is to try and bake in this human inequality?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're both opposed to the same thing, which is that societies collectively should not be able to reimagine the conditions of their own existence, right? Like, that's what they don't think should be allowed, that actually the whole political imaginative undertaking of the last 200 years in all of its, you know, half starts and like excesses and failures is something that just needs to be like solved through a technical arrangement. And for the neoliberals, that's just to say this has always always been just minority populations trying to centralize power for their own interest. So we need to ground it now in something that cannot be questioned, that sits outside of politics, that sits outside of social relations. And for Musk, it's to say that because the metaphor and the reference point for his idea of thinking through everything is the computer, that we should be able to treat humanity like a computer program. And those parts of it that don't act the way that I like it to act are redescribed as bugs or viruses or bots or NPCs or vampires, to use some of the various ways he's described parts of the code base that he finds to be, you know, non-optimized. So it's actually pretty different ways of thinking about, you know, how to get to where you want to go. It's a different train of thinking. And actually, it's a big jump methodologically from the two books, even though, as you say, there's a sort of a similar reactionary quality to their politics. But neoliberals, in the end, were part of a kind of a humanistic tradition that we would probably mostly recognize, right? I mean, they saw the importance of ideas. They saw the importance of persuasion and argumentation. They saw the importance of principles of liberty and individualism, and were trying to figure out the sort of set of laws and state incentives and constraints that could get to their version of liberty. So even if I, you know, often distrust their motives or find their anti-socialism excessive or misguided or even hateful, there is a kind of like, I recognize the way neoliberals of the kind I've been writing about for the most part for the last 10 or 15 years try to engage the problem of politics. What's so alien and actually much more troubling about Elon Musk is he doesn't have any relationship to that humanistic tradition. Like, it's he just doesn't give a shit. Like, he doesn't care about it. He might, as Mark Andreessen or others do, in the most superficial way possible, make some reference to it. Like, oh, this is in the tradition of Iden. Like, they'll just pick a name out of hat, like Locke. Like, they don't actually know anything what they're talking about. Because actually, they're coming at it from the point of view of someone like Musk, who got a programmable Commodore when he was a teenager, saw this as kind of the control unit for reality, and then continued to see the world through the programmable code base, and saw that, again, apparent delusion rewarded in unimaginably huge ways. So when he's in Silicon Valley in 1998, and he says, the internet is becoming the superset of all media. Everything is going to get folded into the internet. You'll have banking, you'll have email, you have mail, you'll have TV, radio, everything, shopping, government, everything will be on the internet. People are like, wow, okay, like that's not going to happen, but interesting idea. Of course, he's right, right? He ends up being right. So his way of like evacuating the human experience from all of those long and winding political arguments that at some level the neoliberals were also the products of, short-circuiting straight to the creation of the programmable personal computer, basically, and saying history starts here and everything else before this is just beyond meaningless, is something that I actually had known kind of intellectually, but only really felt being in San Francisco in the last couple of weeks, where you're just like, I don't know how to put my finger on it, but this is like a city that has turned its back on the idea of humanism.
Yeah,
like,
wow.
The only thing that matters here is how can you plug into this new matrix and how can you make it work better and more efficiently? And it's actually not even about liberty. It's not about individualism, actually. Like, Musk doesn't consider those priorities. It's about the totality of the network that needs to be, you know, cleansed of obstacles and irregularities and made to operate at its highest possible kind of velocity of output. And that is actually, I didn't think I'd be able to kind of black pill myself even more than I had with the previous stuff I'd been reading, but like, wow, okay, I managed to do it. Interesting. Because now we've met people who, like Andreasen, are proud about not being interested in self-reflection, right? Like, who think that that's a fault. And judging again by the veridiction of the market, who's wrong, them or me, right? So it really forces me to be like, look at my own inconsequentialness, like full in the face, and be like, wow, maybe this is just a world where like the things that we all thought mattered just don't anymore. And I wonder if there's any way out of that.
Thanks for listening to the Heist Podcast. We want to say thanks again to Quinn Slobodian and Chapters Bookshop for the event in May. And thanks to you all for listening. Like I said at the top, we had a great response to the first three episodes when we launched in the first week of July. The next episode will come out in 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can check us out at heistberlin.com. Get your daily news, weekly features, weekend event guides, and much, much more. Again, we'd really appreciate it if you could become an accomplice starting at €9 monthly. We are independent. We are worker-owned, so any little bit helps us extend our runway. You can write us any tips or pitches to hello@heistberlin.com. See you soon. Bye.